Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
If you're anything like me, you're enormously grateful that COVID is now in the rearview mirror. While some lingering signs of our fight against the coronavirus remain, the U.S., and increasingly more and more of the world, has moved beyond the pandemic. But if the virus is now largely a thing of the past, its story really isn't. Over the past 2 years, we saw a frenzied fight over the COVID narrative, where the virus came from, who was to blame, and so on, play out on our airwaves, on social media, and in the popular imagination of millions of people. That fight was enormously consequential, because it tapped into larger questions about things like China's role on the world stage, as well as the limits of state power in the West, as well as in the rest of the world. Over time, though, the tug of war over the COVID narrative abated, at least somewhat, as treatments improved and world economies recovered. But now, it's back with a vengeance. The reason has everything to do with a new report from the Department of Energy that suggests COVID-19 may have indeed leaked from a Chinese biolab. FBI Director Christopher Wray has gone even further in his assessment and indicated that he believes it probably did, all of which has reignited the war of narratives over the pandemic and prompted a rush of new Chinese propaganda about the virus. So, what's being said and why? What's the new center of gravity in the debate and the propaganda that surrounds the pandemic? And how does this factor into the larger great power competition now unfolding between the United States and the People's Republic of China? For answers to those questions, I caught up with Michael Sobolev. Michael is my colleague here at the American Foreign Policy Council, where he is fellow in Indo-Pacific Affairs. He's finishing what is shaping up to be a major and massively important book on how the United States can best respond to China's flagship foreign policy project, known as the Belt and Road Initiative. He's also the host of his own podcast, Great Power Podcast, which focuses on the different aspects of America's great power competition with both China and Russia. And if you don't subscribe to it, you most definitely should. I highly recommend it. Because of all that, I was interested in getting Michael's take on China's new COVID propaganda push and what it might mean for them and for us. Michael, welcome to Disinformation Wars.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, Ilan.
All right. Let's start at the beginning. Back when COVID broke out in early 2020, it prompted a global war of narratives. And China was a key player, maybe the key player, because of where most people believe the virus had come from. How did the PRC respond and try to shape the story back then? And what did China's leaders do exactly?
What China's leaders did during that time was spin a web of disinformation on multiple fronts, but two fronts primarily. So I did a lot of sleuthing during those early days of COVID in 2020 and watched pretty closely what Beijing was doing. And you can look at this in a few different ways. So there was outward facing propaganda or disinformation, and there's inward facing disinformation. And it had this really interesting flow to it, Ilan. So there are four main iterations of this. The first stage was right in those early days when before the rest of the world really knew what was happening. The outbreak started inside of Wuhan, and you had these doctors inside of China who were like, hey, this looks like a wholly new coronavirus, and it also looks really deadly. And there was this attempt to sound the alarm. And then you had the response initially from the CCP, Chinese Communist Party, which was caring more about arresting the flow of information than about arresting the flow and spread of the virus itself. And this is where you saw a lot of silence campaigns, a lot of censorship on WeChat and other communication platforms inside of China. You saw the intimidation of doctors. The most famous among them was Dr. Li Wenliang, who subsequently succumbed to COVID and died. You can only stop COVID for so long, right? Eventually it spread and everyone found out about it. So phase number two was this deflection game where the CCP basically tried to say, look, it wasn't us, it was the Americans. The US Army brought COVID-19 to China. And there was like this really ham-fisted conspiracy theories that you saw a lot of Chinese diplomats in Africa and other nations try to test drive. most of that was for domestic consumption to try to stem the tide of anger towards the CCP, the Chinese people itself. But then eventually this morphed from an endemic into a pandemic. And now the rest of the world is mad at China. So the final two phases here, the third one, which was the party's attempt to try to win back the rest of the world to basically say, hey, we're a net provider of public health goods. Here's some PPE that we're going to sell to you. And it was marked up and a lot of it was defective. So even in the moments where the party was really trying to spin the narrative of, hey, this is like China being a global leader, they really did some countries wrong, particularly European countries who needed that personal protective equipment. And then finally, when they had nothing to hide behind and they had a lot of these operations internationally, at least kind of blow up in their face, the fourth and final stage was brute economic coercion. So you had Australia foremost among a lot of these countries say, hey, we should investigate where COVID-19 came from. And then Xi Jinping was like, okay, no more barley imports from Australia. And I had this really intense de facto embargo, I suppose, against a lot of goods from Australia. So the CCP has this weird dualism to it that was on full display during COVID, where they were trying to mitigate these pressures and try to put a good face forward, but they also had this strong arm, both internally and externally, of brute force and brute power. And it's this really interesting tension that you see play out.
That's a really fascinating walkthrough. So on balance here, was this strategy successful? Did Beijing succeed in moving the needle on how people thought about it in relation to the virus? Or was COVID really a turning point in terms of global perceptions of the CCP?
Depends on which audiences you're talking about, I think. So let's start here in America first. Here in America, I would venture to say this was a huge turning point in how writ large political elite in DC began to think about China. Because for a long time, Elon, you and I have talked about this offline more times than I can count. The old consensus about China, while it still tries to hang on for dear life in a few corners of the city, it's not what it used to be. Like the coin of the realm for China policy used to be, we're going to trade them into becoming a democracy. Now that's kind of an oversimplification, but it's not that bad of an oversimplification. But you had this percolation, I guess, leading up to COVID, where we had more and more political leaders recognize that, hey, China is not really becoming more free. It's not becoming more democratic. If anything, it's becoming more intense, more authoritarian, and it's infiltrating us in all of these different ways. But then COVID was really the thing that lit this fuse, because you had this fundamental mismanagement of this public health crisis inside of China. And it was not the first time this has happened. Think back to the SARS issue in 2003, 2004. The party fell into the exact same mistakes, except it killed a ton of people all around the world, including Americans. So this really galvanized the American average politician, I think, too, the American people. If you look at our friends and allies in Europe, clearly none of them were really happy with Beijing. But you also saw that they were hesitant to meet the public outrage of the United States. And part of this was that the Chinese influence in the United Nations, and particularly in the World Health Organization, it's pretty impressive. And I don't mean that in admiration, but just objectively, like their influence at a lot of these international bodies is quite substantial. And you saw this at the WHO, where in those early days, senior leadership, like the most senior leaders of the WHO, were covering for the CCP, and where there was blatant proof that they were not reporting as they should be, they faced no criticism and no pressure at all from international bodies. But where it gets really interesting, I think, Ilan, is when you go to the global south, the developing regions of the world writ large. And the story there is really mixed, and it's difficult to have this big, elegant shortcut phrase to explain what's happening. But I do think it's fair to say that the perspective that Washington has of Beijing is not universally shared in the global south. You saw some nations that were receptive to some of this COVID disinformation that Beijing was spreading. You saw China repurpose the Belt and Road Initiative during this time also. They emphasized the Health Silk Road heavily. And you saw a lot of these developing countries line up in press release after press release to really give Beijing what it needs. Because you can say whatever propaganda you want to say, but for it to be credible, you need a disinterested third party to validate it. And China got a good bit of validators during that time. Just look at their diplomacy throughout Africa, and even in parts of Europe, Italy in particular. So I think it's this mixed bag. And in some cases, the COVID disinformation really backfired on Xi Jinping and the CCP. And we can get into some of that stuff more because there are real examples of it. But in other cases, not only did it not hurt them, I think they got some gains as well.
Well, you mentioned third parties, and I want to pull on that thread a little bit, because to my mind, that's one of the most fascinating parts of this story, because the messages about COVID, about China's role in the world, about whether China was a benign actor, weren't just being spread by China alone. We saw the same narratives and also the same conspiracy theories about COVID's origins and whatnot that were being pushed out by Chinese propaganda outlets, getting picked up and promoted by Russian and Iranian ones as well. And we've seen how all three countries have coordinated their narratives on other things too, like the current Russian war in Ukraine, for instance. So this sort of raises an interesting question, I think. Talk about this phenomenon of authoritarian learning a little bit.
It's interesting, I think, to look at this through the context of Washington's sanctions policies, right? So after the Soviet Union fell and we had this super luxurious period of our nation's history where, wow, great power competition isn't really a thing anymore. And we were unrivaled in our global power, and the US dollar, I mean, still is global currency, but man, like there was just no competition anywhere in the 90s and the early 2000s. We really honed the craft of going after rogue states. Now, when you're talking about rogue states, like in the super like nerdy Washington speak, that basically means Iran and North Korea, like nations that are not so powerful that they can go toe-to-toe with the United States on anything, but they are very clearly breaking all the norms that Washington wants smaller states to follow. And you see a lot of these quote-unquote rogue states punching above their weight because they're going for asymmetric advantages. One of the biggest ones, as you know very well, as your listeners also know, is the nuclear capability, again, Iran and North Korea. In a lot of ways, Washington will do its best to isolate any regime that is operating in a way that not only goes against America's interests, but also against these global norms and practices and institutions that America wants to perpetuate. But what we've seen and seen documented over and over and over again is that these regimes, when they are faced with the prospect of diplomatic or economic isolation, will turn towards each other. And if you look at the track record of the Iran nuclear program and their ballistic missile program, North Korea's fingerprints are all over it. And like vice versa too, like these two, like Tehran and Pyongyang have worked together for decades. I remember when I was a staffer in the Senate. When you're a Senate staffer, you don't do anything super nerdy or wonky, but I had at least one of those super wonky projects, which was laying out in the form of a letter to the then Obama administration, this intense documented cooperation between Tehran and Pyongyang for these nuclear programs and missile programs. It's very rational in a way for these regimes to turn toward one another because they have competitive advantages that the other regime can benefit from. Now, if you look at that in the disinformation space, in the COVID days, I do think that there was some desperation, because if you are the regime in Tehran or in Pyongyang, your public health infrastructure is not that strong. Are you prepared for a pandemic compared to a developed country or even other developing countries? You're at a severe disadvantage, in part because of that isolation that we just talked about. So I think a lot of that initial piggybacking on that COVID disinformation was blame shifting, because a lot of these regimes are afraid of their own populations. They really are. Like, this is an endemic problem with authoritarian regimes. And if you see another dictator test driving some sort of regime proofing disinformation and it works for them, hey, maybe it's going to work for me too. And you saw that spread in a lot of cases. But I think it's more than just dealing with your own populations. It also has to do with the fact that there's overlapping interests between a lot of these regimes and how they see the United States. And there is this perception, I think, among a lot of these capitals that Washington is beginning to slip and its power edge is beginning to marginally decline. And this is why I think China was even as bold enough as it was to try to position itself as a net provider of public goods, of public health goods. And Russia and Iran, as you mentioned, with impunity spread that disinformation and just falsehoods, blatant falsehoods that COVID came from the United States. It has to do, I think, with the fact that if you can introduce uncertainty at any degree, you achieve victory, right? And you even saw this come back in some of the super extreme discourse here inside of America as well. So I think it made a whole bunch of rational sense for this like authoritarian regime learning from each other. We've seen it in other cases, but we're really starting to see it in the information space too.
All right. So let's fast forward to today, because all of a sudden this war of narratives over COVID's origins and the virus itself is heating up again. Why now? And where is this all heading?
So I think for a couple of reasons. The domestic reason is this ongoing saga in our own American politics of where did COVID-19 come from? And we recently just had the Department of Energy revise their estimate of the origins of COVID. Now, as assuredly all of your listeners know, the two leading theories, was it the wet market or was it the lab? And the majority of agencies inside of the U.S. intelligence community, the IC, have assessed with varying degrees of certainty that it was the wet market. The FBI, up until very recently, if I remember correctly, with moderate confidence, has assessed that it was from the lab. And recently, the Department of Energy switched its assessment, and they're now assessed with low confidence that it came from the lab and not from the wet market. Now, obviously, we're talking about intelligence, so you and I only have so much information about why that shift happened. I would love to know what it was, but this is spurning this ongoing debate again, because the lab in Wuhan, as has been incredibly well documented, was into some really relevant gain of function research and testing. And the types of viruses that they were working with are eerily similar to COVID-19. So I think that's one reason why you see this domestic resurgence of the conversation. But I think honestly, the more interesting reason is the international one, specifically the China reason. COVID zero was the Chinese Communist Party's response to COVID-19. Now, COVID zero, it's really important to be clear about what we're talking about. When we talk about lockdowns in the context of China, we are not talking about what the American people went through in the summer of 2020. This is not you and me working inside of our home and taking sanity walks for a couple of months. Like, it wasn't ideal, but we survived and we could still go to Trader Joe's or Aldi or Giant and get our groceries, right? People inside of China were welded shut inside of their apartments, inside of their homes. Daily mandatory testing. And if you tested positive or if a close contact of yours tested positive, you're shipped out to a quarantine facility for a certain period of time. And this was incredibly draconian. And you saw like pets being killed out in these public courtyards because they were so afraid of COVID spreading. It was very inhumane. But what we saw late last year, right before Xi Jinping, right around the time, it was bubbling before and certainly right after he paved the way to getting his third term as the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party and the top man inside of China. Right around that time, you saw this groundswell of anger and angst and intense frustration of the people of China basically saying, we can only take so much and we are reaching a breaking point. Now, there were sparks that kind of lit that fuse, but the general zeitgeist was we have had it. We have absolutely had it with these lockdowns. So the party had to pivot insanely quickly. And this was, in many ways, a judgment on Xi's handling of COVID, because zero COVID was his policy, baby. And one of the biggest reasons for that was China refused Western vaccines. Their vaccines were not great. Sinopharm and Sinovac did not have good inoculation rates compared to Pfizer and Moderna. And their elderly populations were not vaxxed at a meaningful range for them to be safe. And on top of that, the infrastructure for their public health was not where it needed to be. Like, sure, they can build a hospital in a couple of days, but that's a whack-a-mole solution. The infrastructure that you really needed for 1.4 billion people was not there. So that's a really long way along of saying it's back in the news again, because the CCP had to pivot on a dime and then in the process spin this entirely new propaganda yarn that we are victorious over COVID. And it happened completely overnight. And for, I think it was one of those moments where it happens every so often inside of China, but the veil gets pulled aside and the weakness and frailty of the party is exposed every so often. And I think it was one of those moments.
Well, and you, I think, anticipated my question. You call it COVID zero, I call it zero COVID, potato, potato. But we're getting at the same thing, which is the fact that the original, the orienting Chinese response to the pandemic was enormously intrusive, and it effectively walled off the PRC from the rest of the world. And like you said, it not just figuratively walled off the PRC from the rest of the world, but in many cases, you had quarantines affecting millions of people, draconian state restrictions, and oftentimes these policies had tragic consequences. So I wonder, this sort of raises the question to me, how did the PRC, before it pivoted on a dime, before it ended zero COVID, which we'll talk about in a second, but before it did, how did the PRC explain what it was doing to its own citizens? And how did it message the rectitude of its policy to the rest of the world? Because Chinese policy was very different from what the rest of the world was doing.
It was so, so different. It's so interesting. This conversation actually takes me back to a lot of conversations I had with colleagues over the past few years, where we'd look at each other and from an American perspective, again, like from an American perspective, we would ask each other, what are these guys doing? What in the world are they doing? And I think this is where, if you get stuck in that mirror imaging trap, nothing that your adversary does will make a whole lot of sense. But if you're able to put yourself in their shoes and get some of their own historical flavor, you start to see some sunlight come through. And honestly, the analogy that I kept on finding myself coming back to, and I saw others suggest as well, was the Great Leap Forward. Now, for your listeners who don't know what that means, turn back in time with me to the 1950s and 60s. In the United States, we're transitioning out of the peace and tranquility of the suburban life of the 50s into the cultural upheaval of the 60s. Like that's the history we know. But in China during that time, man, like these are the days where Chairman Mao, right off the heels of defeating Imperial Japan and defeating the nationalists and gaining control and establishing the People's Republic of China, he was bound and determined to have industrial output that would surpass Great Britain. Now, you don't have to know much about China's history to know how utterly insane that desire or prospect was. China was agricultural. It was so pre-modern in its economics and its society that it beggared belief that this could even be done. But Mao, the ever optimistic communist that he was, thought he had a plan. And the Great Leap Forward was his plan to jumpstart industrialization inside of China. But what actually happened was mass starvation. The Great Leap Forward is one of these tragic episodes of history where like tens of millions of Chinese men, women, and children starved to death across the country. But it was all in the name of the wisdom of, not just the wisdom of the CCP, but this idea of a mass campaign. And this is something that I think you see in a lot of ideological communist countries. this top-down command is given, and then there's very little clarity as to how to achieve it. And it's left to the underlings and the local comrades and the provincial comrades to figure out, how do we do this? And also, like, how do we fake some numbers along the way so we don't get in trouble, right? I think, Ilan, you saw very similar dynamics play out inside of China during COVID, because Xi Jinping, for his own reasons, which not morally, but strategically for his own security, I understand, he didn't want to accept Western vaccines. So if you're not going to do that, your options get really slim really quickly. And the option that he chose, because the party is really good at total control, was to try to totally control the virus, the spread of the virus, the mirror opposite of what the party was doing in the early days, ironically enough. And this meant that the goal was zero. When we say zero COVID or COVID zero, what that zero means is zero cases. It's that draconian. And the party likes, you know, idolizes and worships the will to power. They always have. And if you're going to try to eradicate a pandemic, what better way to do it than to have this, you know, really almost godlike belief that we are powerful enough for zero infections. Now, in reality, we know that's not true. Like, regardless of the numbers that they were reporting, we know that it was never that case. And one of the pieces of information that one day we may know is the actual death toll inside of China. Who knows? They haven't reported it. But I think this ideological frenzy of the party must control it, and then this pressure that's on these local and provincial underlings to figure it out and err on the side of intense enforcement because they don't want to get in trouble with Beijing, it was this really unvirtuous cycle that perpetuated itself. Again, like the straw that broke the camel's back was this episode in Xinjiang where there was this apartment fire and the fire trucks couldn't physically get to the apartment because these cars that had been undriven for years had dead batteries. Like, no one could move the cars to get to this apartment complex, and those doors had been sealed shut because of zero COVID. So the people were stuck inside. This was one of the things that galvanized the protests that we saw last year. And so it takes a little bit of an effort to get outside of our American vantage point to understand some of that stuff. But I think that's some of what was going on.
You know what I find the most fascinating aspect of this whole story? It's what isn't being said. Because what isn't being said is just as important as what is. And you talked about zero COVID being over and being over very abruptly as a result of political considerations in Beijing. I think that's absolutely right. Because what we saw in the aftermath of the Party Congress was a very rapid cessation of zero COVID, practically overnight. And what you saw as a result, very predictably, was a massive wave of coronavirus infections in China. Yet, as you've noted, we heard very little about this. And what strikes me here is what could be called the law of large numbers. You know, the idea that even a small fraction of a large number is still a large number. And that formula should hold for COVID fatalities in China as well, because of the size of the Chinese population. But instead, we're hearing the Chinese government talking about how it won a quote unquote decisive victory against the disease. So what's really going on here? Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yes, I can, Ilan. So when you're talking about the law of large numbers here, so back of the napkin, there are about 1.4 billion people in China. If you look at the mortality rate of the, let's pick a COVID variant, let's pick the Omicron variant. It's more transmissible, but not quite as deadly as I think the Delta variant and some others, right? So Omicron, if I remember correctly, it was about a 0.4% mortality rate for those who contract it. So if you do that simple math, on average, you should expect to see around 5,600,000 deaths from the Omicron variant inside of China. Now, that is not all the variants, that is just Omicron. So if you want to look at the initial virus and the other variants as well, and you add all those estimates together, what you get is a much larger figure. There are tens of millions, at least like tens of millions likely of deceased Chinese people because of COVID-19. The figures that are officially reported from the CCP say otherwise. But I think that I agree with you that that context is really helpful here, because China has projected a sense of victory in how they've responded to the virus. This is all over Xi Jinping's propaganda globally and especially domestically. And when we talk about disinformation and we talk about China, something that I am adamant about, whether I'm talking to congressional staff or folks inside of the executive branch or others, is one of the biggest weaknesses that Beijing has is its need to not only just like traffic in disinformation, but control information totally inside of its own borders. I feel like you and I keep coming back to this word of control. It's easy to see that as, oh, well, the fact that they can, you know, censor the internet, the Great Firewall and all that stuff. Like to Americans, we're like, man, that's pretty impressive. Like our government doesn't do that, thankfully, First Amendment. But there's a difference between looking at the capability to do something and the reason for doing something. And even though the capability is impressive, objectively impressive, I do think the motive that they have to traffic in disinformation and control information at all reveals severe weaknesses on the part of the regime. And they can, you know, conceal the death toll all they want. I think we are on firm ground with the assumption that the COVID reality inside of China is far grimmer and darker than has been reported.
I'm positive that it definitely is. And I think there's another practical reason for it as well, because if you look at the way China's outward-facing propaganda has worked over the last several years, it's been, at least in the developing world, it's been all about telling what the Chinese call good stories about China. China as a benevolent funder of infrastructure, China as a provider of PPE, personal protective equipment during the pandemic, so on and so forth. That narrative and that appearance of strength really starts to break down if you're not reporting thousands of COVID casualties, if you start reporting millions of COVID casualties, if you show the bankruptcy of your own approach to the pandemic. So I think those two things are intricately linked. That control that you talked about domestically has to be mirrored by control over the narrative, because otherwise the whole edifice of the CCP's competence begins to fall apart. Anyhow, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Ilan.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.